Institute's been doing a lot of work on amyloid, tau, and looking at their role in dementia. And Dr. Rebecca Nisbet runs a group which is looking at antibodies that might pull tau out of the cell. And she's actually developing mRNA technology, which is putting the genetic message to produce this antibody into cells. And they've had some promising early results.
The amyloid pathology accumulates before we start to see loss of memory. So by the time people are already exhibiting loss of memory, the amyloid plaque pathology has already maxed, essentially, in our brain. So it's very hard then to go back and target that and hope to see an improvement in cognition. Tau, on the other hand, accumulates after. And that correlates really nicely with when we start to lose our memory. So we'll be able to identify people that are starting to lose their memory at the same time we're starting to see the tau accumulation in the brain. So it gives the drug a really good opportunity of working.
But the problem with tau, of course, is that it's harder to tackle because it's inside the cell, whereas amyloid's outside.
That's correct. And that's why we have been using mRNA technology to target tau within neurons.
So what you've done is you're using this mRNA technology, in other words, sending messages into cells to produce an antibody in the hope that that antibody can then get inside cells and tug out the tau, so to speak. So just describe the experiments you've done before we get on to some of the implications.
What we've done is synthesized the mRNA that encodes our antibody. And that acts like an instruction manual for our cells. And we've shown that in the lab, we can apply this mRNA that corresponds to our tau antibody. We can pop it onto our cells. The cells then take up this mRNA. They can read it and then produce the tau antibody themselves. And we've actually been able to show in the lab that the antibody that these cells produce is within the cell and can bind to tau directly in there. And we believe this is actually the first demonstration of a tau antibody being able to directly bind to tau within the cell.
But the next stage is you've actually got to give the mRNA, a bit like a vaccine, which is going to go into what cells and how are you going to guarantee it's going to get into the brain? I mean, which cells in the body do you think are going to produce this antibody? And is it going to be every cell in the body? Because you're not going to be able to just target very specific brain cells.
Moving forward, we'll be combining our mRNA with lipid nanoparticles that we are attempting to engineer to be able to cross the blood-brain barrier and deliver.
So these are like little carriers for your vaccine. In a, well, it's not really a vaccine, but your mRNA to carry it in and take it inside cells. And are you going to be able to target that so it goes inside nerve cells rather than other cells in the body?
No, we won't be able to specifically target neuronal cells. The good thing is that neurons are more readily able to take up lipid nanoparticles compared to other brain cells.
And are there animal models of Alzheimer's involving tau that you can use here?
Yes, we have models that form these tau tangles, and they also exhibit motor and cognitive impairments as we see in humans. And so we'll be testing our mRNA therapeutics in these mouse models.
I mean, is it a bit like an mRNA vaccine? Once you've given it, it's going to last for a long time?
No, unfortunately, it will require multiple doses. Over time, the mRNA will be cleared from the cell. And when that happens, the cell will then stop producing the antibody. So it will require multiple dosing.
And how do you avoid what's called off-target effects, where the mRNA might go into your bowel or your heart or other parts of your body? We don't really know what sort of effects this antibody could have on other cells that have nothing to do with tau.
We hope that if we have a brain-penetrating peptide attached to the lipid nanoparticle, we'll be able to have majority of those particles go into the brain. But obviously, we're going to have to conduct numerous safety studies to ensure that the delivery is safe.
Nonetheless, an exciting first step.
Yes, very exciting.
And when I say first step, you probably spent years on it.
Yes. I have been developing tau antibodies for a very long time. Obviously, the mRNA technology has been more recent, but it's very exciting.
Well, good luck for the future, and we'll have you back on when you get to the next stage.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Dr. Rebecca Nisbet, who's group leader at the Florey Institute. And it's one of these frustrating things that you and I do all the time, Tegan, is that we get people to talk about their lifetime's work in 5 minutes. And thank you very much, and go home.
It's my favourite part of being a health journalist.
Yeah, just explain it. That's fine. Forget about the agony in doing that. There's also some interesting research which we've been covering on sudden infant death syndrome, which is sudden unexpected death in a child under 1 year with no cause found, despite testing and postmortem having been done.
It's one of those things that I absolutely lived in terror of when my babies were little, and I'm sure every parent's the same. And there's all these risk factors that they tell you how to guard against.
Yeah.
Don't smoke, don't sleep baby on tummy, be careful what kind of bedding you put them on, nice firm mattress and that sort of thing. But that doesn't account for all SIDS deaths.
No. And the rate of SIDS deaths has dropped, particularly since the sleeping campaign took place. And most parents will do the right thing and sleep babies on their back. And that's made a big difference. But still about 3% of infant deaths. And there are about 1,000 babies who die in the first year of life in Australia. So about 30 babies die of sudden infant death syndrome. So it's still a mystery. Mm. So a group of researchers, including a paediatric pathologist, Dr. Robin Haynes of Boston Children's Hospital, took a new approach. It's called metagenomics, next generation sequencing. Effectively, what they're looking for are the genetic footprints of lots of different proteins and situations that might exist within the baby, such as inflammation, maybe infectious organisms, viruses and bacteria and so on. Looking for their genetic footprints, not just looking for the human genome in these babies. What they discovered through this very wide-ranging process, that they found evidence of brain inflammation and a hitherto unexpected virus called the human parechovirus.
We did omic analysis, like you said, and two different types of omic analysis. One was to look for bacterial or viral species because we are interested in infection and neuroinflammation and how that might contribute to SIDS. So we did an analysis, it's called metagenomic sequencing, where we can look for the sequence of bacteria and viruses. So that was one aspect. And we identified a virus that isn't typically looked for at autopsy. And we would not have known this infant had this virus had we not done this. But then the second omic study we did was actually to look at the RNA, which, like you said, is the product of the gene. And we did that in a small number of cases, and we saw really profound inflammatory response within the brainstem at the level of the RNA.
But in this one particular child, they got this infection, and then there was a profound immune response in the brain to it.
That's right. That's not to say the others didn't. It just wasn't detected. But at this point, we don't know why the others had the increased level of neuroinflammation. But had we not looked at these particular measures that we did, it would not have been known. And so the bigger takeaway point of the paper is it really takes new, different, more detailed tools than what's out there as standard autopsy procedures to really detect some of these underlying causes.
And did you do standard genomics on these babies? In other words, look at their gene pattern? Because one hypothesis, I'm supposed to be jumping the gun here, but one, I'm putting words in your mouth, but one hypothesis here would be that some babies carry a gene when they get infected by a virus that might be otherwise trivial in a baby that doesn't have that gene. If they've got that gene, their response to that virus is quite profound and life-threatening.
That is an excellent question, yes, and that is something we're very interested in. We did actually look at the genetics of this one particular case, and nothing stood out, but we are very interested in that question. And that hypothesis has been around, like you said, quite a long time, and many other people are also looking at that hypothesis as well.
What do we know about this virus, this parechovirus, also called HPEV3? What do we know about it in other children or adults?
This particular strain, it's becoming more prevalent. I can't remember when it was discovered, but it hasn't been terribly long, you know, relative to the other viruses that we know. And this particular strain is more prevalent in younger infants. And typically, you can get sick and be fine, and it's not a concern. But there are cases where it can have neuro effects, so it can be damaging to parts of the brain in some infants. And rarely, it can cause death, and even more rare, acute death, as was in this case here.
As you say, it's terrible to say the word interesting when you're talking about kids who've died and there's such a family tragedy. But what is interesting here is that by putting on different spectacles technologically, you see an entirely different world biologically in these babies.
Well, that's exactly right. By using these new techniques, like you said, we have now a different lens that we can look at these SIDS cases under. And the hope is that as we start to use these new technologies, we can really dig into SIDS more deeply and really understand the different causes, the different underlying pathologies that we would not have been able to see before.
And finally, Robin, this was partly funded by an Australian charity.
It is. It was partially funded by Rivers Gift, who has been really supportive of SIDS research and SIDS families for years.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Dr. Robin Haynes is the Department of Pathology at Boston Children's Hospital.
Well, that is it for the Health Report this week. We'll be back in your feed next Saturday morning. But if you can't possibly wait till then, why not go and have a listen to our other show, which is called What's That Rash?
And this week we're looking at painkillers. Which ones work best? Ibuprofen, aspirin, paracetamol, take your choice. It's a fascinating story.
It is interesting. I'm most interested to know about what we know about how they work in the body, which I won't spoil for you here. Go and listen to the show. All you have to do is search What's That Rash wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And we'll see you next week.
See you then.